time to listen to the interviews from last Saturday's Island Life. Island Life is our weekly magazine show focusing on Waiheke people, events and issues. It's brought to you by Placemakers every Saturday morning from 10 till 12. Last Saturday, I talked to the new chairperson of the Waiheke Community Board, Tony Sears. Opinionated Islanders Alan Knight and Alex Stone, Lyndall Jeffries, who's coordinating a class on art appreciation at the Waiheke Night School, Steve the Butcher, Rosalie Hennigan from Waiheke Library, and Sue Pocket and Joe Woodward, who have plans to revive Rocky Bay. First up, Tony Sears. Tony Sears is in his third term, I think that's right, isn't it, Tony? Second term on the Waiheke Community Board, and he's served for some time as the Deputy Chair on the Board. Now, during Tony's time, of course, there's been a number of difficult issues. They've been dealing with the proposals for development of Matiatia. You were around when that was still going on, weren't you? I think people have kind of forgotten about that now. We had the whole discussion about whether Waiheke should have reticulated sewerage or retain the septic tanks. And, of course, there's Nobelangelo Kiramalis' proposal to join Thames Coromandel. However, there are some big issues facing Waiheke at present. The issues aren't behind us. We have the whole question of local control of waste management, transport, and, of course, the shape of local democratic structures in the new Auckland governance regime. And it's these issues that Tony Sears will have to navigate Waiheke Community Board through in his new role as the board chairperson. So, Tony, welcome along. Are you up to the job?
Well, as you say, this is my second term on the community board, so I have a bit of a familiarity with how the community board works now. I think it takes a couple of years before you get to really understand how things are going. I think so. I think I have the confidence of the board, and I have confidence of a lot of people within the community. I've had a good mentor in the past. Ray Erickson, I think, has been an excellent chairman. So I guess what I would want to do is carry on the good work that he has been doing.
Now, this is an interesting time for the board because really we're in this period of transition now and we don't really know what it is that we're transitioning to. So how do you hope to find your way through that?
Well, I think the next 18 months are going to be critical for the Waiheke. The Royal Commission came out with a very strong statement about the need for Waiheke to have a lot of delegated responsibility and a lot of say about its own local affairs. And I think everybody on Waiheke would have been heartened by that. There is going to be an establishment board set up to implement the super city. And I think for our community board, it's going to be very important that we have input into the establishment board, so that we have a direct line with them. The fact that we have a community board is a great thing, and when there were only going to be three, we thought we were pretty special. Now that there are going to be perhaps 30, we've got to be very careful that our particular community board roles aren't diluted to fit in with the rest of Auckland, Greater Auckland. So I think that our community board is going to have to be very articulate in expressing what we want for our community as the establishment board sets up the delegated responsibilities for local boards.
And, of course, one of the things about the present time is that we've got this focus, of course, on what's going to happen, you know, with Auckland governance, but there are a number of current issues that are still on the table, aren't there, such as the district plan.
Yeah, well, the district plan got its sign-off through council, I think, two Thursdays ago. I know that there are people on the island who will oppose various aspects of the district plan, and I think that's it's a good thing. Our community is very quick to read through, you know, the hundreds of pages of stuff and find the bits in there and tease out the bits that aren't good. And I think through the submission process, both before the draft plan and now up to the final plan, a lot of work has gone on our community. As the district plan becomes more well known and widespread, I think there will be people in our community who will make statements about that. I don't think we can ever get everything right, but I think that a lot of really good work by both planners and Ray and Councillor Mulholland and so on has gone into this plan, and I think it's worth the community having a good look at it.
And what about issues like, you know, the service centre and the library? Do they all just get dropped now and put into the let's wait and see, or are we still moving ahead on those?
Auckland City Council has a policy of business as usual. So they have signalled that they want to have the service centre here and the artworks with the library. I think that's contrary to all the consultation that's happened on Waiheke Island. I don't think there are many people on this island who would want to see the service centre smack bang in the middle of Aniroa. We don't want to see artworks become a dual function area. Artworks, we think, is for the community and is for artistic pursuits. So as a community board, we will be fighting very strongly that the service centre remain at Ostend. There is the opportunity for people to make submissions to the long-term council community plan, LTCCP, in which the idea of having the service centre beside the library was mooted, so it's a perfect opportunity for people to respond to that.
Okay, now let's look at your role within the board itself. So you're planning on changing some of the responsibilities that people hold there. Tell us more about that.
Well, it's timely that we look at the responsibilities that people have in light of the change with Ray and I and Herb. Some of the responsibilities that Ray has had are ones that would normally be taken by the chairperson of the community board. One of those would be emergency management. It just seems that at this time it's a good opportunity for us to all look at our own responsibilities, those bits that we feel we're doing really well, those bits that we think perhaps could be done better by somebody else. So it's just an opportunity to review our delegations. It is likely that many of the delegations that people have, they'll continue to hold, but it's just an opportunity for us to revisit those.
So aside from the emergency management, are there any other particular areas you've got your eye on?
I've been looking after youth, and it's something that I'm pretty passionate about, and I probably want to stay with that given that I work at the high school. I've been working with the police. That's something, I guess, that's negotiable. Most of the roles that we have, I think, could be done by anybody, although we do have particular roles. We're lucky that in the community board, most of the members come from different areas within Waiheke, so I'm responsible for Anutangi. Herb's responsible for Palm Beach, Noble Angelo's responsible for Rocky Bay, Eileen for Aniroa and so on, and obviously they would stay as they are. There are some big portfolios that people do. Herb's responsible for transport at the moment. He may or may not decide that he wants to change from that.
Mm. Now, is the board together at the moment or are they divided? I mean, the reason I ask is, when it comes to the election of the deputy chair, because your election was pretty much unopposed, but the election for deputy chair was a little more fraught with a suggestion that rather than have a deputy chair, that the role be shared out amongst the others.
And I think there was merit in that suggestion. The reality is that the community board has got to work together. It can't be just one person or two people. I think for Auckland City Council, they would prefer to have a deputy chair because then they know that if something happens, such as happened with Ray, where he was incapacitated, there was clearly another person that they could go to for leadership and for comment. From that perspective, I think there's a sound reason in having a deputy chair. Also, it means that if I can't get to a meeting and Herb is representing the community board, he comes with the mana of having that deputy chair role. But the reality is, and I think the thing that we need to take away from the suggestion by Noble Angelo, was that in fact all of us need to work together and that we sometimes need to delegate into subcommittees to do things.
And with an eye to the future, do you see yourself moving on and having a role in the new board structures which will emerge out of the, after next election?
I think a lot depends on the responsibility that is given to each local board. I've got a full-time job at the high school, and that's pretty much, certainly a very important part of my life.
And that's an interesting point, isn't it? Because I think in the past that was always the case. Even councillors would have full-time jobs and then be a councillor on top of that, whereas now certainly councillor is the job. And with the change to community boards, it may become that becomes more of a job, although I can't imagine there'll be a lot of money attached to it.
Well, I think that's the issue. I mean, one of the things that we've been really blessed with Ray is that he's used virtually all his retirement to be on a community board and to be working pretty single-mindedly for the community board. There are other community board members around Auckland who have got full-time jobs. I'm not alone. But I think in the nature of the new local boards, if there is going to be real delegated authorities and powers, then it may require much more of a commitment than is required today. So I'm, like everybody else, looking really carefully at what's happening, looking at opportunities. Certainly I am very passionate about this community, but I'd have to be realistic too about the amount of work involved.
Yeah, okay. Well, thank you very much, Tony, and again, congratulations on becoming chair.
Thank you, Chris.
Just remind listeners that there is another interview with Tony, which was on our Vocal Local show, where we talked more about the governance and the Royal Commission, and you can check that out by going to our website, www.waihikiradio.org.nz. Cheers. On the first Saturday of every month, we're joined on Island Life by our opinionated islanders, Alan Knight and Alex Stone, to give us their take on local issues and current affairs. And they're here with me this morning. Good morning, gentlemen.
Hi, how are you?
We're very good. We're just talking about the rain and whether it's a good or bad thing. So you like the rain, Alex?
Yeah, rain is good. I reckon to be rained upon is to be blessed. I think when you consider all the planets out there, and we're the only one that has rain, so let's celebrate it.
What about you, Alan?
I think it's great. The garden's coming up beautifully, and it's going to be a nice day tomorrow. And plus, we just filled the spa pool, so we need the water to top the rain tank up. So, yep, let it rain. Yeah. Why not?
Yeah, there's probably a song somewhere that says, let it rain, let it rain.
I've already played a song called I Like Rain earlier on today. Rightio, so now there was some news in the paper this week about an investigation going on in Auckland around possible corruption around the
allocation.
I love it.
Put it this way, the Herald certainly hasn't used the C word yet. It's a very interesting breaking story, though, the fact that Auckland City Council have found it necessary to call in the Auditor General's office to have a look at how certain roading and footpath contracts were awarded. And working on the basis of never believe anything until it's been officially denied, we hear the sound of various officials saying, we've got nothing to hide.
Yeah.
Which I think translates as, we reckon we've shredded all the appropriate incriminating documents. But I think for Auckland City to have even got this far is a very interesting indication that somebody has been caught out.
Yeah. So it's a lovely story about the old Auckland Old Boys Club, you know, and the issue at stake here is one of footpaths, which is quite a nice one too. When you think Waiheke said, we don't need footpaths, and the poor fellas in Auckland have overpaid for footpaths. The money's in the bank somewhere, but they didn't get the footpaths.
And, I mean, historically, New Zealand has had fairly low levels of corruption, and all of the studies that look at it put us pretty well on international ratings around that, and I think there was some...
But it makes us boring from a satirist's point of view.
Yes. But also that when small amounts of corruption begin to happen in cities like Auckland, everybody's terribly coy about discussing it. It's very difficult to get a public debate going on whether various officials at Auckland City are being paid off or awarding contracts to people who've done favours for them and so forth. We're all terribly scared to actually say the word, you know, is this corrupt? Yeah. And well, I think finally we are seeing something that genuinely is, but I think we've left off the debate too long. And there's certain people for whom it's just, oh, what's everyone getting upset about? Yeah, sure, I got a new yacht out of it, but are you telling me that was wrong?
Ellen and I are having an interesting discussion just before we came in here. Ellen was proposing an interesting theory about what are acceptable levels of corruption in a city. And maybe this is just our start at it, you know, we're trying.
Yeah, I think in a society like ours, we don't want to see Auckland become like Sydney, where payoffs and backhanders are sort of part of the accepted way of doing things. I think it would be a shame if Auckland ended up like that. And I think it's also noticeable that the whole wheelie bin fiasco is probably further indication. I think if the Auditor General's office was to look at the the way in which those wheelie bins have been purchased, there's some documents need shredding there.
Well, yeah, I mean, that whole, I mean, the fact that they've already bought them, you know, it does make you, well, it's more than wonder, isn't it?
Yeah, follow the money. I mean, who authorised the buying of those, and what did they get as a result of passing on all that business to the Australian company that makes them?
There's a nice symmetry about this as well, with Waiheke always being a little bit to the side of Auckland. And, you know, there's this corruption scandal in Auckland about the overpaid footpaths. And here we've got wheelie bins that have already been paid for that we don't want. And the big problem with wheelie bins here is we don't have footpaths to put them on, and we don't run footpaths in the first instance. It goes around in a sort of nice little confusing circle.
And I mean, I suppose that leads us to the point that most of the, you know, most of the time when people think corruption, what we've actually got is a monumental cock-up.
Yeah, absolutely. It's the old thing, if you suspect a conspiracy, it's usually a cock-up. And maybe that's what we're doing here, you know. And maybe we're too coy to talk about that as well. We're not big enough to say, you know, we cocked up.
Who do you think's the biggest on conspiratorial theories? Is it the left or the right?
That's an interesting
point.
Because I think one way of answering that, while you think about it, Alan, he's still thinking. I'll do the talking. But one way of starting to answer that is, my theory is, any group of people, however well intentioned or whatever their political leanings, have the same level of incompetence. So the left or the right can have the same ability to make mistakes. So which side suspects the other side more is an interesting point.
I would say when it comes to really flamboyant conspiracy theories, the right is where you've got to go. Left-wing people generally have quite a gloomy world view that, you know, oh, yes, well, we're downtrodden and it's always going to be that way, and if we have solidarity, we can fight back. The left generally don't come up with any really spectacular conspiracy theories, whereas right-wing people tend to get really flamboyant when it comes to feeling paranoid about stuff. Yeah, you've only got to look at right-wing America right now.
And even in New Zealand, where there is, in the blogosphere, quite a theory that Helen Clark is going to the United Nations to introduce world communist regime.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right. Well, imagine if we exported Rodney Hyde. What would they be saying then?
Goodbye and good luck. Okay, so, but, you know, back to this topic of the, you know, the muck-ups, the stuff-ups, the cock-ups, whatever you want to call them, and, you know, we do see those quite a bit, and there are some, of course, that just kind of stick with you, and we've currently got this fiasco going on in Quarry Road, up above Palm Beach, But that's not the only, and I think everyone has a favourite example of some council cock-up or contractor cock-up somewhere along the line, don't they?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. The first one I was going to think of was the time that Artworks Theatre was having the front of the building reclad. They brought in a whole truckload of brand-new timber, reclad the front of the building, and then somebody pointed out that all the insulation that was supposed to go in there was still on the back of the truck. So down came all the brand new timber in bits to be taken to the tip and thrown away. The insulation was put in, and a whole truckload of fresh timber was brought in and put up on the front. That was a particularly egregious example of quite how stupid some of the contractors that work for the council are. I think, though, the one that's really must stick in everyone's throat at the moment is what they did to Hill Road. How long did it take them? 2-3 months to rip Hill Road up? Reseal it, put all the drainage in, and look at it now.
Yeah.
It's actually worse than it was before.
Yeah, I've often wondered if there's a guarantee for, you know, roads. How long should they last? The Romans put down roads and they're still around. And, you know, in the 20th century, we put down a little tar road and it fell apart, what, in 3 months?
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, let's not forget the Hill Road footpath. Now, the boardwalk, that was a piece of work. So that went in, and what, the spans were too wide, so
yeah,
they went up and down,
very
like bouncy, and then they broke.
Yeah.
And then someone realised, oh, actually the spans are too far apart, we need to put another one down the middle, so let's rip up the whole thing and do that. Yeah. And then it was raised up, and cars were running into the edge of it. So then we had let's put the concrete bollards, and then the buses run into those. Let's take those out and put the white reflective poles. Oh, no, people run into those. That doesn't work either. Let's put a wooden board. I think we've gone about... that must be the million-dollar boardwalk.
Yeah. Well, I walk down it every so
often. And, of course, the other thing is down the bottom of Hill Road. What is it about Hill Road?
The circle.
It's got a curse on it.
Yeah.
The turning circle where they were all set to put in the little traffic island until somebody went, oh, hang on a minute, the buses can't get round that. Mm. Now, that's the level of incompetence that we're dealing with a lot of these local issues from local government.
What intrigues me is that most of these things, there was an engineer or a couple of engineers who got well paid to make these cock-ups. And for me, that's curious enough in itself. But the ones that really get me are the ones that have an element of mystery. These ones we've been talking about are pretty clear cut. It's a straight cock-up, fix it, done. But remember the bumps, the speed bumps in front of the in Ostend? They were a monumental cock-up, but then their disappearance was a mystery.
Yes,
a great mystery.
It's not that mysterious. But I'm saying no more.
What I loved about that was that everyone was saying these do not work. It is, you know, it's a ridiculous idea, and you know, and the response from council was, well, yes, but, and you know, and even if we were to get rid of them, it's a huge exercise and it will cost $10,000. And do you really want us spending the money on that?
Yeah.
And then one night, they were gone.
They're just gone.
Now, you've got to wonder at the level of effort that was involved in those, because they were fastened to the ground with steel threaded bolts going into the tarmac, all of which had to be cut off at ground level, which would have involved angle grinders and all sorts of stuff. That would have taken a lot of noise.
And I'm figuring, though, that the people who did that didn't spend $10,000 doing it.
No, they didn't.
No.
They barely spent a cent. Where are the traffic? Where are the speed bumps now? Because they've never turned up. Mm-hmm. Are they hidden in the same place where the ram scrotum is?
Yeah, I was just about to say, if we're talking, extending the story of cock-ups, where is the ram's balls?
Yes, exactly.
Where are the ram's balls?
Yes, the investigation is ongoing.
What I want to know is, are they going to change the name of the team to the sheep?
Yes.
And are they going to rebuild the ram's tackle or what?
That's true. Is there a campaign for
restoring the ram to
what's
wholeness?
The word? You have someone asked me this the other day.
It can be
you know, if cows are bovine and pigs are porcine, what are sheep?
Ovine.
Okay. Yeah. So the campaign for ovine testicular
restoration.
Yes. Yeah, I'm all for it.
But I don't think you can be.
Bring back the scrotum.
Yeah, but you can't be effectively unneutered. I mean, that ram is now an ox. What's the word for an ox ram?
Surgeons can do wondrous things, Alex.
Yeah, it's made of concrete anyway. I say yes. Bring in a new scrotum and fix it back on with glue.
Yeah, attach it. Yeah.
Now, of course, in a world class city, a ram would have its scrotum intact, wouldn't it?
And, absolutely. You know, yes.
So does that mean we're not in a world class city?
Yeah, this is an interesting point, because this is the cliche of the month: the world class city. Which makes me wonder, are we now obliged to become a world-class island? And what does it take to become a world-class island?
I think I think Waiheke's achieved that anyway.
Yeah, but what are the defining features? Because for me, the one thing that really, truly makes us world-class is the faulty tower-esque quality of our restaurant industry.
Oh, definitely.
That's
yes,
world-class.
Yes. There are some spectacularly rude folks running hospitality on this island, and I think that's great.
Maybe that's our branding for the future. We should say to the world, this is one, you know, come to Waiheke and you can get world class. It's faulty towers wherever you go. Total world class.
Yep. Because in fact, there was one particular business on the island where the local bus drivers, when they were bringing people in, would actually say, we call this place Faulty Towers. their particular Basil Faulty has gone now. He's off the island, but his rudeness and unpleasantness in dealing with customers was truly world class.
Yeah.
You could have made a good comedy series out of that.
And that's one thing that worries me, because if we are to become a world class island, we need to keep the colourfulness of all our characters, you know. And I'm afraid, are we losing them?
Oh, I don't think so. I think in general, people on Waiheke are as
world-class colourful.
As world-class colourful as they've ever been.
Well, there's still plenty of colour out there, isn't there? I mean, there's still you know, there's still enough weirdos. We haven't been completely run off by the rich and wealthy. In fact, you could say that the tide has turned.
I think
the weirdos
definitely
are winning.
Yep. Oh. I mean, there was a piece of really splendid weirdness in the Gulf News letters page this week from the gentleman in Onitangi who wrote in attacking the media and defending Tony Veitch, Frankenbeinie Marama, and Lee Kuan Yew.
I know, and it's fantastic.
Any other world-class monsters you want to feel like standing up for? Yeah. That was an extraordinary letter.
I read that as well. I thought, let's all strive to be Singapore.
Yes.
Let's all strive to be the place where we lock up our political opponents.
Yes. And
jail people for putting chewing gum on the ground.
Yeah. I think the gentleman concerned who wrote the letter is one of these people who has this view that everything would be a lot simpler if everyone just jolly well did what they were told. Mm. And then if you have authoritative rule, that's going to work out better for everybody.
Yeah. Which begs the question...
I couldn't agree less.
Could Waiheke ever have a benign dictator? Would that be possible?
I think it might be. But I think the only way you can achieve that is to... Because, a lot of people talk about, we should be a republic. I say nonsense. I think we should be a dukedom,
yes,
or a principality.
Yeah, I don't think we've got
that.
What it takes to be a republic.
No, we don't, because for a republic to function effectively, everyone has to get involved, and we know people don't want to do that.
Yeah.
So, really,
Waiheke is a fantastic political engagement.
Yeah, it does, but I still think a principality is what we need. We need to just find somebody plausible and not too bright.
But who'd be our
who
royal
can
family?
Wave nicely. I don't know.
Now, there's a question. Who would be the royal family?
I can think of all sorts of people that could do the job. They
need to be thick to start.
They have to be thick, yeah.
A little bit eccentric, well inbred, you know.
Yeah, and capable of waving and smiling nicely.
Yeah. Open-top car.
Yes. Because if you did that, you have... The nice thing, I think, about that kind of rule is that the population do what they like and the monarch lets them.
Yeah.
And you really couldn't ask for more than that.
Yeah. Well, there's an interesting trend around the world of these micro-nations, have you heard?
Mm.
Yeah. And there's a great one in Western Australia. Some farmer got pissed off with the wheat board and declared his farm a micro-nation. He's got his own currency and a bed and breakfast, and he's got, chains and offices of, yeah, the whole thing. So we could declare ourselves a micronation, a dukedom, a fiefdom.
That would be fantastic. I mean, I think if Waiheke could even achieve the same level of autonomy that Norfolk Island's got, would be a start.
Yeah. But you see, if you go back to the world-class city thing, one thing that's been bothering me about this, the principality kind of nature of it is, if there's going to be one mayor where there were six... One poor bugger is going to have to wear six mayoral chains around his neck.
Yes.
He's going to end up looking like that guy from A-Team. What is the guy with the bling?
Yeah, with all
Mr.
Bling.
T.
Well, maybe
help, I've fallen. I can't get up.
But maybe there's a couple of mayoral chains that we could use on Waiheke.
There'll be spare ones.
Yeah, mm-hmm. We could use them for the principality.
Yes. Yeah. I was talking to Tony Sears before. He's just taken over as chair of the community board.
Good on him.
Do you think that because you've got the, like you were saying, you have the council and the mayor has the chains?
Yeah.
Do you think that Tony has a necklace?
It wouldn't suit him.
Yeah, no,
it definitely wouldn't suit him. No, he's a down to earth sort of chap.
He's a good guy.
I'm delighted to see him get as community board chairman.
Yeah. But he's also not quite the character. Tony's a really good guy, but would he be the prince?
No, absolutely not. He wouldn't have the flamboyance.
He wouldn't have the level of silliness it would take.
No.
So who are we going to find if we go that way?
Ooh.
You see, if we became a republic, then Tony would be dead right.
Yes. Yeah. Answers on a postcard, please.
if we
were to establish a royal family of Waiheke, who has the requisite skills?
Yeah, and skills being inverted commas.
If you have ideas on that, then please contact us. You can email us, studio@waihekeradio.org.nz, or if you're on Twitter and you're following us there, which is twitter.com/waihekeradio, you can send us a reply your ideas.
Just remember, not too bright.
We
don't want any monarchs with ideas of their own. They're there to simply do as they're told.
Yeah. But they do need to be colourful, eccentric.
Definite waving skills.
Yeah, yeah. Mm. And colourful, eccentric, the occasional wacky idea, and sort of odd hobbies.
Yes. Good odd hobbies. Yeah. Preferably ones that don't involve torture and things like that, like the old-fashioned kings used to do. We need something a little more benign than that, I think.
Yeah, we could be a world-class something other than, wouldn't we?
We could start with a world-class radio show, perhaps. Okay, that's the Opinionated Islanders, Alan Knight and Alex Stone, joining us here. They'll be back again next month. Thank you very much.
A pleasure as ever.
Yes. Pleasure as ever. And do send your suggestions in to us.
Long live the king. Queen, it could be a queen. Yes.
I'm going to turn your microphones off. you do send your suggestions to us via Twitter or email. We're finding out about the night school. We've talked about the night school before here on Waiheke Radio. The night school's run through the Community Education Centre at Waiheke High, and they have a whole range of courses which they offer term by term that people can get along to and pick up some new skills. We ran a podcasting course there a few months back, which was very successful, and there's a whole range of new courses coming up starting this week, and you've got, I think, until the 11th of May to enrol. So we're going to find out about a particular course this morning, which is art appreciation. The number of other courses that are up and going, you can still enrol for, like woodwork skills, Italian for travellers, and digital photography, all have got places available. Let's find out about art appreciation with the tutor of that course, Lyndall Jeffries. Good morning, Lyndall.
G'day, Chris.
So, art appreciation. So, if I go along to this, you're going to tell me that I should like those kind of blobs and paint flicks on canvas, eh?
I'm definitely not going to tell you what you should like. One of the first things that I've got on the course is a big screen which says, I don't know much about art, but I know what I like. And I think most people are like that. They know what they like. They come across artwork, it either appeals to them or it doesn't. So I'm definitely not going to be telling people what to like, but I'm going to be giving people a whole lot of background information about a whole range of New Zealand artists, about a whole range of different art genres, and we're going to be learning some skills that actually help us unpick artworks when we're confronted with them and we're like, I don't get that. You know, where do you start? How do you start unraveling the meaning behind an artwork? How do you find some clues that'll give you some access? And you can still like it or not like it. It's up to you. It's all about having some fun, some exciting discussion, some stimulating evenings with a group of interesting people and maybe a glass of wine or two.
So, I mean, I've often wondered about this, you know, sometimes, well, periodically, not lately because I don't have any money, but, you know, every once in a while people will go, oh, I think I should get into art. And, of course, they can't afford any of the big names. And they go, well, okay, well, I'm going to buy something. I'm going to buy something by an emerging artist. How do I know if it's any good? How do I know if I'm getting something which has some staying power or something which is a load of rubbish?
Well, this is going to be part of what the course is going to address. There's all kinds of things that make a work valuable within the art market. A lot of them, especially with New Zealand art, have got to do with its relevance to New Zealand history and New Zealand culture and, if you like, the history of New Zealand contemporary art. If you look at some of the more successfully collectible works, i.e. an artist by the name of Bill Hammond, whose works go for up to $200,000, this is an artist who I'm going to be really looking at quite closely to see what it is that makes his work so valuable.
Is he the guy with the birds?
He's the guy that paints the birds. But his work refers to New Zealand history. It refers to a specific history of a guy called Buller who collected basically all of the birds in New Zealand, stuffed them and sent them to Britain. He's basically responsible for the extinction of the Huia. So this is the starting point for Bill Hammond's bird work. So it comes from a very strong moment in contemporary New Zealand, colonial history, and his work has got a real contemporary edge because he's addressing some really deep issues within New Zealand culture.
So, I mean, what form will the course take? You're starting off with a picture and you're going to sit around and kind of, you know, talk about it, or are people going to be creating, and or how will it go?
Well, it's a bit flasher than that. I've gone and taught myself PowerPoint. So I'm going to start off with a 45-minute presentation of three artists, and I'm going to address a different sort of theme each night, or a different art genre, if you like. So we're going to have a night looking at figurative painting, one looking at abstract painting, another looking at digital art, another at installation art, photography, and we're going to look at three artists each evening, and I'm going to give a really nice presentation in the dark with some gorgeous images that we're all going to look at and discuss, and then we're going to have a break and a bit of discussion, glass of wine, cup of tea, maybe some home baking, And then after that, we're going to do an exercise. And some of the exercises are really good fun. There's one where, for the installation evening, I'm going to ask everyone to go off and make a little installation around the classrooms. They're going to have a go at doing it themselves. But it's not so much a practical course. It's probably more a course where we're looking at discussing things in pairs or small groups and then bringing our findings back to the group. There's going to be lots of really gorgeous art books there as well for everybody to flick through. And, we're just going to have some fun.
Okay, and you've got a field trip as part of the course as well?
Yeah, well, we were hoping to go to Connells Bay Sculpture Park, which I've discovered is closed in the wettest months of the year. So I'm now planning to take everybody over to Matakana to Brick Bay Sculpture Park, which is really, really stunning. It's a 5 kilometre sculpture walk. And so we're going to go on a bit of a mission that weekend, but I've got one of those people movers and I might know of one or two other ones we can get our hands on, and we'll go off on a big mission to really see some work out there in the field that people haven't seen before.
Great stuff. So, art appreciation. Now, to enrol for this course, you need to get hold of the community education at Waiheke High. You can give them a call on 372 6417 or email inquiries at waihekecomed.co.nz. The easiest way to find them, actually, is to Google Waiheke Night School.
And absolutely.
Good luck with the course, which starts on when?
Well, it's going to start on Wednesday of not this coming week, but the following week. It's from 7 till 9 p.m. The course is $100 for 8 sessions. So
cheap
it's
as chips.
Cheaper than a yoga class. And it's going to be really neat because instead of sitting at home watching crap TV on a Wednesday night, people are going to be really learning something and really developing some skills. And great. I'm really looking forward to it.
Lyndall Jeffries, thank you very much. And it's our pleasure every fortnight here on Island Life to talk to someone from the Waiheke Library and find out what's going on over there. And this morning I've got Rosalie Hennigan with me. Hello, Rosalie. How are you?
Good morning, Chris, and good morning. A wonderful wet morning. Just the sort of day that you can't get out in the garden, but you can still read. So it's a great library day. And I'd like to start off by inviting you especially to come along for 11 o'clock because we're celebrating Music Month in the library. So it'll be today at 11, it'll be the Waiheke Choral Society. They are so gifted.
We recorded them performing the Messiah just before Christmas last year, and that was a great performance.
Yes, and I think you're going to record them today too.
Or in fact, the whole series, which I know you're going to run through everyone that's playing, but that whole series throughout the month of May, every Saturday, we're going to record all of those and rebroadcast them here on the station.
Fantastic. So we're starting off this morning with the Waiheke Choral Society, 11 o'clock till 11:30, so come along and be in the audience. Then at 9th of May, that's next Saturday, we're having the Waiheke Orchestral Ensemble. They're going to share some of their favourite pieces. The 16th of May, we've got Full Stop, who are rock steady versions of ska.
Oh, they're fantastic. They're a great live band. They're going to rock the library up there for sure.
And Youth on Ukuleles with Anu Grace on the 23rd. Anu is one of my favourite island performers. She's just so gifted.
In fact, we've got a new song by her we're going to play very soon as well.
Oh, excellent. And then last of all, Ian Simpson, Powerful and Passionate Delivery, supported by Andy Lewis on the mandolin. And of course, I've heard Andy playing before and I think he's really quite wonderful. So that's the Saturday, every Saturday at the library to celebrate Music Month, and not just New Zealand Music Month, but Waiheke Music Month at the Waiheke Library. Now, I should get on to books now, and one of the books I read recently was one of those items that I spotted a couple of years ago and thought, oh, I must read that. That's the lady who did Books and Homes and the Gifted Kids program. In other words, I'm talking about Christine Fernyhough's book, The Road to Castle Hill. And, Chris, it's a wonderfully inspiring book. What I liked about it was I got the background on the ideas for the books and homes that she worked with Ellen Duff, because Ellen came up with the idea of how some of these children had never had a book in their lives, and so they're a bit antsy books, and so he thought, we aren't going to lift literacy until these children can treasure books. So Christine Fernyhough is quite a wonderful person for fundraising and things like that, and she worked on this book with Louise Callan, and So I read about the books in school, books in homes, and then, of course, she decided there was, talking to teachers, there was a need for the Gifted Kids program, so she set that up too. And after she lost her husband, she had had a bad time with his illness and grief and over his loss, and so she wanted to do something completely different. But I must admit, when I heard that she had bought a High Country station, and I knew Castle Hill, frankly, from living in Christchurch, it's marvellous, beautiful to look at, but I thought, oh, I'd never want to farm it. That's the farmer's daughter in me coming out. And all I can say is she's done brilliantly. Mm. She actually works the farm herself, and my hat's off to her, or it would be if I was wearing a hat. So that is a book which I can recommend thoroughly, The Road to Castle Hill, Christine Fernyhough, a New Zealander, a woman who's quite inspiring. And talking inspiring and books, I may have talked about this a year or so ago. It's John Wood with the Room to Read program, and again, it gives the background for how he set up that program. He was actually, has a link with New Zealand and Australia. He was a Microsoft guy in charge of Australasia, and he liked to get away from anything that could reach him by going trekking in Nepal. And one time he went there, and he got talking to the local head teacher of this little school. So he said, would you like to see our school? So this guy said, oh, yes, how hard a climb is it? He said, oh, nothing much. Several mountains later, he got to the school, and he was shown, oh, this is the classroom, and this is where things. And he noticed there was no books. And so he said, oh, our library's here, and he pointed to a cupboard, and backpackers had left. I think there was a Danielle Steele, and there was a trekking book on somewhere totally different, like Holland or something, you know, totally irrelevant for these children in their lives. And so John Wood was very taken with this headmaster, and he said, well, is there something I can do to help you? And he said, oh, if you could send us some secondhand books, that would be fantastic. So John Wood, that's how it started, and now he's built, I think it's something like 7,000 libraries throughout developing in third world. He gets a local director, in this case he used the local school teacher, and from that he got another school wanting help, and he decided, well, you know, it's no good giving them books if they've got nowhere to put them. So he actually physically built the books, libraries with the local teams, and that's the secret of the success. And then, of course, so many people came to him and said, we don't just need a library, we want a school. So now he's built 765 schools. This was up till about February this year. And I think the actual figure for the library then was 7,040. That's in Nepal and India and Vietnam, Cambodia. And the other thing that he's caught up with is the fact that so many girls are not sent to school. So he's got a special program for girls going. Just a wonderfully inspiring story. So there's, for a wet day, two things to show you what one individual can do. So you'll find these stories at the library.
It's time for our weekly catch-up with Steve Hill. Steve, the butcher from the Village Butchery, Waiheke's only specialist butcher here in Oniroa. You guys sound like I'm on commercial radio. How are you, Steve?
I'm very cold, actually.
Very cold. Yeah, it is. It is cold. So we were talking about how to warm up on a day like this, and chilly.
It will initially warm you up, but the general idea of the hot food with chilli is to make you sweat to cool you down.
Well, yeah, I suppose. So maybe not the best for a cold day, but it is very, very good.
But it does.
For me, winter or summer, chilly is it.
Do you like the hot?
I do. I love the hot.
Hot. A lot of people get confused when they ask things if it's spicy. They mean, is it got lots of chilli? But spicy can mean a whole lot of things.
Cardamom, for example.
Cardamom?
Yeah.
That is quite a warming. It's more in sort of the head that things, you know, cardamom, cloves, cinnamon.
Nutmeg, maybe?
Nutmeg. To a point, it's not, that's more of a sweety sort of flavour. Star anise, cloves, just little hints of those do bring a feeling of sort of inner warmth, especially if you've cooked something nice and long and slow. You know, your lamb shanks or beef shin on the bone, that sort of thing. Something that's going to really stick to your ribs and keep you warm. There's no reason why you can't put a bit of chilli in there, I suppose.
Well, I suppose I would be. Yeah. Okay, so, yeah, well, that's interesting. I hadn't really thought about that, about the fact that chilli actually is about cooling you down, isn't it? Because it's from those hot climates that it's coming from.
Yeah.
Yeah. Although, like, last night I was out, and someone had actually made some... Actually, it was Alan, who's going to be on very, very shortly, had made some meat patties with some of the mince from your shop and stuck a chilli in that, and boy, was that good.
Oh, don't get me wrong, I do like hot stuff, but it's just that thing of, is it spicy? You know, it's almost exclusively chilli, that's what they mean. Things like cayenne pepper... And even some paprika will give you some heat, but without the, you know, the ferocity of a chili. Some people get a bit burnt, shall we say, or once burnt, twice shy sort of thing.
What about all this bravado nonsense that goes on as well? You know, I'm going to have the hottest curry out kind of thing. I mean, people get carried away, don't they, and they actually start to lose the flavour.
I don't mind it hot now and again, but as you said, it does take away from the actual flavour of what you're eating. I knew a Malaysian guy, he used to actually eat raw chilies. He was basically addicted to them. He got such a buzz out of them, he just kept eating them and eating them. It wasn't doing his internals much good. He did suffer... for his addiction, shall we say. But, you know, sometimes hot can really spoil the sort of flavours that you're eating. And then you end up having a lot of yoghurt and things like that.
Overwhelms it, doesn't it? I mean, you've got all the subtlety and the flavour that comes from those other spices you were talking about, and then you blast it through with some screaming hot chilli and away it goes.
Well, that will just take over everything. I mean, you might as well not bother with the other stuff, really. If you're going to eat the chilies, I mean, one of the best things you can do to get the flavour is probably just remove the seeds and the pithy bit. And that is where the major source of the heat comes from. Then if you want to get a bit braver, maybe leave a few seeds in there. But I don't think it's a good idea to overpower stuff with too much, because you just end up being very red and uncomfortable.
And you must have seen people ruin some pretty good cuts of meat and some pretty good food with poking too much spice in it, or too much, I suppose, not even necessarily chilli. You can overwhelm it with anything, can't you?
I think a lot of people would start cooking something and have a taste and think, oh, that's not got that flavour that I wanted, rather than let it sort of develop and cook. They'll chuck a load more in, and eventually all you've got left is something that tastes foul, for want of a better word. It's some spices can overpower quite easily.
Do you think New Zealand cooks have the grasp of spices? You know, I mean, I suppose until maybe, I don't know, it's a while ago now, maybe 20 or 30 years ago, it was pretty unadventurous and there wasn't much used. And if, you know, you went to someone's spice cupboard, they probably have, you know, cloves, cinnamon, black pepper and mixed herbs. you know, now we've got a much greater array of flavours that have come through, you know, particularly from Asian food that people will have in their kitchens and in their cupboards. But do they know what they're doing with them, do you think?
It has changed, certainly since I first came to New Zealand 20-something years ago. There is a greater variety out there, and people are getting a better understanding of what they are. It's probably because a lot of people are travelling and they'll go to Asia or wherever and try the food, like it, come back and experiment with it. I mean, at the end of the day, it's what you like. It's, you know, like wine and things. I mean, if you like a $4 bottle of wine, that's your business. I don't know why you'd drink a $4 bottle of wine, but...
I tell you what, if you know where to get $4 bottles of wine, tell me.
But, I mean, it's a preference thing. A lot of people do nowadays have got a lot more understanding and freedom, I think. Before, they were kind of Monday is this, Tuesday is that, and that was as far as it went. But nowadays people do seem to be experimenting a bit more, and the acceptance of stuff, a lot of things are now everyday sort of staples in people's cupboards.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, there was a time even when rice.
Rice, yeah. I'm in trouble serving rice to people. Rice, the noodles, garlic even. Garlic was a no-no not that long ago, but now it seems to be in everything. It's just people's experiences, I think. It's, there's a lot more stuff on the TV, cooking programs, there's books, magazines, so, you know, there's a lot more stuff laid out in front of people, so, you know, they will experiment. There's only a few different ingredients from what they'd normally make, and it changes the meal completely.
Yeah. All right, so have a go at your spicy food. Don't be put off by the chili factor. And, top tip there from Steve, you know, if you want to warm up, chili might not be the best option. Thanks very much, Steve.
Okay, cheers.
Steve the Butcher from the Village Butchery joining us here on Island Life. Now, Rocky Bay residents feel that they have something special going on over there, and even though it's only a few minutes' drive from Ostend, it does feel like you're entering a different Waiheke when you descend down O'Brien Road. But in recent times, however, Rocky Bay has seemed a little bit like a sleepy hollow. Since the shop closed out there, the bay has lacked a centre and a meeting point, a place where people could get together or a bit of community focus. And it's for that reason that Rocky Bay residents Sue Pocket and Joe Woodward have hatched plans to establish a regular Rocky Bay market, and they're here to talk with us about that this morning. Good morning to both of you. Well, let's turn on some microphones, eh? There we go. Good morning.
Good morning.
Okay, so tell us a little bit about how life in Rocky Bay has changed since the shop went. So you've been out there since the shop, haven't you?
Yeah, well, when the shop was open, it was really good. We used to drive past and there'd be people sitting outside having coffee and cake and see your friends there, and you'd stop and have a chat, and it was really fun. But then the store burned down and there hasn't really been anything like that since, so we're hoping that our market will provide that, at least on Sundays.
And Joe, you came along to Rocky Bay after that, but obviously the place still has an attraction, and it does have that feeling when you talk to Rocky Bay residents about having it. Well, I suppose in the same way that Waihekians feel we've got something special in comparison to Auckland, but Rocky Bay has just got that a little bit more, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's another subculture. Again, like Waiheke is very special. It's a community that's you just can't find on the mainland. And then Rocky Bay is another community again where you just can't go for a walk and not run into people or drive. It sort of takes you sometimes 20 minutes, half an hour to get out of the bay when you're just going to the supermarket, and then the usual when it takes half an hour to get round Woolworths with the Waiheke community. But people that live in Rocky Bay are just passionate about Rocky Bay. It's just sort of like the old part of Waiheke where it's a wee bit untouched with all the weeds and trees and everything.
And so what do you hope that the market will achieve? I mean, you know, there's plenty of opportunities for people to go and buy tech, but you're obviously looking for something else. What are you hoping that it will provide?
Well, we're going to give priority to people who make what they sell themselves, and we're especially interested in arts and crafts, and also in organic food, which there's going to be quite a lot of there.
So other than providing a place where locals can just walk to get their fruit and veg and their cup of coffee, it's hopefully going to flush out a lot of talent that's within Rocky Bay, because there's a lot of arts and crafts people that tend to live amongst the trees. So we'd like to flush all those people out and give them an opportunity to sell their wares locally.
And we really don't want to restrict this to Rocky Bay people who come to the market. I mean, as you mentioned, Chris, it takes 5 minutes to drive from the Ostend market to the hall. A lot of people in Waiheke seem to think Rocky Bay is the back of beyond, but, you know, it's not really. It's not far at all. So we're hoping that Waiheke in general will support this market.
And so, you are going to be trying to get Rocky Bay produce and goods there as well?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And whereabouts is all this going to happen?
In the Rocky Bay Hall, which is just opposite the burned-down store, which is at the end of O'Brien Road. So if you take the Rocky Bay turn off and drive past the Roosters and past the dirt track, you turn right at the dirt track and just keep following the main road until you get to the flagpole and you're there.
Provided we get all the council approvals and the
approvals. Well, we're hoping it's going to go ahead.
And tell us a little bit about that process. I mean, you know, someone has a bright idea and goes, okay, here's something we can do which is going to be good for our community, good for our locality, and it's going to give local people an opportunity. What stands between the idea and making it happen? tell us more, Joe.
Oh, no, I don't want to.
Well, I mean, in our case, we have to get the hall kitchen registered first. And that's a bit of a process in itself. You know, it has to go through the committee of the society that owns the hall, and it has to go through the council, and then we have to actually do it. And we have to get a permit for the market, and what else? That's about it, really, isn't it?
Market license.
And we have to get stallholders who are interested in selling stuff at the market. It's going to be an all-weather market because it'll be inside the hall. So we're hoping that winter won't matter too much. I noticed that driving past the Ostend Market this morning that there was almost nobody there because it's pouring with rain, of course.
And do you think there's room on Waiheke to sustain the Ostend Market and Rocky Bay Market? Are you going to do this
absolutely.
Weekly?
Yeah, absolutely. We'll certainly start off weekly, and with the hope that it will be pumping and our community would embrace it.
I think the thing is that this is going to be on Sunday. A lot of people can't get to the Ostend Market on Saturday morning because they have sports or they have work, or Saturday morning's just not good for them. But this is going to be, hopefully, on Sundays from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m, so you can come along at 10 o'clock and have brunch with your friends, or you can come along and have lunch and a picnic, and it's not going to close till 4 o'clock. So it'll be something to do on Sunday. There really isn't a lot on the island that you can do on Sunday at the moment.
So it's certainly not to compete with the Saturday Ostend Market.
So when this becomes a roaring success and you have, you know, more stallholders that you can fit into the hall and everything, what's the structure behind this? Is it a business venture you're putting forward? Is it a community initiative? What is it?
A bit of both.
We're hoping that if it does become a roaring success, we might be able to expand down to the reserve in Mary Wilson Reserve down at on the water.
In the summertime.
Maybe in the summertime, yeah.
See, the Rocky Bay store was patronised quite well by the boaties that used to come into the bay, and I'm still picking up people when I'm driving out to the bay, out of the bay, that have rowed in to shore with the idea that they were going to purchase something from the store, and then finding that the store isn't there anymore, they're hitching a ride to go out to Woolworths.
And actually, you see it on the bus all the time as well, don't you? People getting on the bus and the tourists, and they go, oh, Rocky Bay, that looks good. You know, they've seen the photos and it's a beautiful location. They've gone, let's go there. And then they kind of get there and they go,
there is nothing.
Yeah. And there's some amazing walks too that centre out from the roundabout there at Rocky Bay where the bus comes in. So if we could sort of tee up with some guided walks at the same time as the Sunday market, it would be amazing. Because it sort of does prevent people from enjoying a walk when they can't purchase water or something to eat.
Yeah, there used to be a market on Sunday at Artworks here, but it hasn't been running for several years now, and although there's still a sign down by the boat saying it's here. And I think it was an excellent idea to have some sort of market on Sunday, because a lot of tourists come over on Sunday morning, and it's, you know, it's interesting and fun and colourful and very Waiheke, I think. Well, we're hoping it will be.
And if you can manage to jump through all these hurdles, and believe me, we know about dealing with bureaucracy here, getting the station started had a fair bit of that to deal with, when do you hope to have all this going?
We'd like to have our first market on the Sunday of Queen's Birthday weekend coming up at the end of May.
Great. Yeah, so that's the, I can't remember the date, is it? But yeah,
31st of May.
31st of May. Yeah, great stuff. Okay, well, good
luck.
So
anybody who wants a store, please call us.
And how do people do that? If people are interested and they want to get involved, what do they need to do?
Well, my number is 5394.
And mine is 4005.
Yeah, and you've got a web address or email or something like that that people can go to?
Woodward@ihug.co.nz, if they could drop me a line.
Great stuff.
Great.
Okay, and keep us posted with how it's all going.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Thanks, okay. Chris.
That's Sue Woodward and, sorry, Sue Pocket and Joe Woodward from Rocky Bay, and talking about their plans to establish a market there and coming up, hopefully, Queen's Birthday weekend. Now,
you've been listening to the interviews from last Saturday's Island Life. Island Life is our weekly magazine show all about what Waiheke people are thinking and doing. It's brought to you by Placemakers every Saturday morning from 10 till 12. We replay the interviews on Wednesdays at 7 o'clock, and they're also available as downloads or to be listened to online at www.waihekeradio.org.nz.